Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota Chief Justice David Gilbertson gave his State of the Judiciary address yesterday. You can hear the entire speech online, but today we welcome Chief Justice Gilbertson to In the Moment from Peer. Sir, welcome back to In the Moment.
Thank you.
I want to talk about the content of the speech, but before we get to that, I want to talk about its structure, because I think you're such a great speechwriter. So if you will indulge, we're going to play the very first joke, a clip from yesterday's address, how you start out your speech. Can we just take a listen real quick?
If I might be accorded a moment of personal privilege before I start the message, the Lieutenant Governor mentioned that my father was a minister. Well, my mother was a surgical nurse, which had one wit quip. When I became a justice, minister, nurse, judge. Well, I guess the Gilbertsons will save you one way or another, whether you want it or not.
Warming up the crowd there, sir.
Yes, it was well received.
And you go throughout this speech and you quote everyone from Oliver Wendell Holmes, JFK, James Madison, Ronald Reagan, the Prophet Amos, your mother-in-law, Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, Benjamin Franklin, Mark Twain, Abraham Lincoln, and Thomas Jefferson. How do you prepare for these speeches? And you must enjoy the process of putting it together.
It's a year-long process. In fact, we started on next year's today. as I see a quote I think would be a good fit, I set it aside and then probably about May, start putting the pieces together. Obviously, events happen after May, and really the final product isn't put together until probably late November. But I do write my own speeches. My father, who I referenced there, was a minister, said you could always tell when somebody spoke publicly whether they'd written it themselves or it was some canned thing that somebody else had wrote. Mm-hmm. And he said there was a distinct difference. So taking that to heart, I write my own.
Why does it matter?
Well, I think if it's what I am trying to convey as Chief Justice, it better be something that I actually said and think, rather than something somebody handed me and said, here, read this.
Hmm. You start out after sort of welcoming everyone, expressing your gratitude for elder abuse legislation, Senate Bill 54. Tell us about the success story as you see it that came from that legislation.
Well, I thought an update was appropriate because when I gave the speech last year, it was merely a proposal and nobody knew really whether it would pass or in what form. So it was an opportunity to and I think 41 or 42 of the legislators are new this time. So they weren't here last year. So it was an opportunity to try to remind everybody about the bill and, more importantly, to thank them for passing the bill that's already now in effect. One part, as an example, is the Attorney General's prosecutor, and in just 6 months, because the law didn't go into effect till July 1st, in that six-month period they've had 135 referrals, the Attorney General was quite surprised that it would be used that much that quickly.
Is there some validation because of that number? Not that you want to know that there are that many people who might have an issue with how elders have been treated or how they have been treated, but does it sort of validate the fact that it was very much needed in the state?
Right. It confirms the suspicions.
Right. So let's go on to some of the things we're looking forward to. Mental Health Task Force. You and I have spoken about this before. It has some very focused intentions. And I'm wondering, as I listened to you in the State of the Judiciary address, I thought the residual effects of this, if this legislation goes through, could be pretty wide-reaching. How do you feel about that?
Well, it is in a way, but the mental health issues are much broader than what we're trying to focus on here. We are just simply trying to deal with a problem, and that is people sitting in jails and not being able to go in front of the judge because there's a question if they're competent. Because in order to enter a plea to a criminal charge, the defendant has to be able to assist in their defense and understand what the charge is. And we don't know why, but the number of evaluations ordered tripled in 2 years. I wish I did know why, but it did triple. We know that for sure. And the ability of the State Human Services Center was capped at 32 persons a year. Well, with the tripling of the number of people needing evaluations, that was 147. So that doesn't bode very well for prompt analysis of these people's mental health. Mm-hmm. So we had to come up with a plan B, and this proposal is the plan B.
And another key element of it is this expansion of crisis services, telehealth services that deal with, not only evaluations, but people who are in a crisis. And that's where I'd sort of jumped ahead to that could have effects that resonate, far and wide, really.
Right. I mean, I used the example yesterday of what is a sheriff supposed to do when he picks somebody up in a rural road in a rural county at 2 a.m., talks to the person and says to himself, something's not right here. Where does he go? What does he do? Right now, he probably has no options. Hmm. This would allow him to go back to the office and get on a telehealth phone line and probably get some professional assistance as to, one, whether he's got a problem with this person who he's just arrested, and maybe more importantly, how to deal with it.
Hmm.
The sheriffs I've talked to are very enthusiastic about this option coming to pass.
You're getting a lot of support from Governor Dennis Dugard and from law enforcement officers throughout the state as well. Is that what you're sort of feeling?
Yep.
In these early days of the legislative session?
Very clearly with the governor. I mean, he said right. So the day before, the state of the state, but he has been behind this project 100% since he and I sat down and talked about undertaking it.
Mm.
I mean, the decision for the project was a joint one to begin with between him and me.
Right. New wave of evil has descended on our citizens talking about methamphetamines. That's a bold statement. Is it new, and how so?
It's new in the extent of the amount of addiction. I think if we'd had this conversation 4 years ago, clearly there was meth in South Dakota, but it was probably mostly confined to the cities, and now it's just all over the place. You talk to any rural sheriff, and they will tell you it's simply out of control in their rural counties. The other problem, too, is that the meth has gotten much more deadly by injecting other types of drugs or chemicals. As I used the example yesterday, if you washed out of our drug court because you had consumed meth a couple of years ago, the worst that would happen to you is you went to the pen. Now you can die. And we actually had two people in our program die of overdoses this past year. So it's come to South Dakota.
Not every ending is a happy ending.
No.
In this. Why was it important for you to include in your talk with lawmakers and really with the state of South Dakota? Because the speech, as we mentioned before, is available online. You can find that at listen.sdpb.org. Listen to it in its entirety. Sir, why was it important to really make sure people understood that some of these stories, through the best of everyone's intentions, end in a tragedy?
Well, I think examples bring the problem home. If you just get up there and read statistics, people's eyes tend to glaze over and numbers only go so far. But when you talk about a person who died of an overdose, who had only 3 weeks before graduated from our drug court and had been clean for 2 years, that to me kind of brings it home.
Mm. Anything that can be done about that? Do you have a sense that you just wish you could flip a switch there? Do we not understand the nature of addiction fully, or what can be done?
Well, it would be lovely to have a switch, but I'm not naive enough to think one exists. I think the other issue, too, is when we started drug court programs in 2008, we thought we had a pretty good idea what the nature of the problem was, and we did in 2008. But now the situation's completely changed, and the assumptions that we had in 2008 about the nature of the problem are no longer what the problem is. Drugs are increasing in every area of the state. The potency is increasing. And a lot of these people in 2008 were trying to hide under the radar. And now a lot of them are brazen enough, they're carrying guns. So the situation's got a lot more dangerous and a lot more serious.
So talk to me about those specialty courts, 16 of them, and the economy of scale and how they've sort of grown.
Well, the idea was to have a drug court in every town in the state that is large enough to have the counseling services that are an essential component. We now have that. We have 16 of these programs in every town, large enough to hold one, the last one being Brookings, which we opened this year. And we significantly expanded the size of the programs and Pennington and Minnehaha County. And so that goal has been achieved. And some of the courts in the towns that maybe don't have quite enough clients to run them separately, drug and alcohol, we've combined them. Mitchell would be an example. They do both. And they have about 16 people in the joint program. And so that is kind of what we saw. We would love to take those programs into the smaller counties, because 48 of our 66 counties in South Dakota have a population of under 10,000. The problem is there's not counseling services available in those smaller counties, so we have instead come up with the HOPE program, which we are having good results with in the rural counties we've used it so far.
And the HOPE program stands, it's an acronym, right?
Well, yeah, we had to change it because the original one, H, stood for Hawaii, because that's where the program came from.
All right.
We thought, well, that might not sell too well in South Dakota. And so we did change the name. Somebody more creative than me came up with the name.
All right. Let's talk about the Rural Attorneys Program and the expansion of that. Give me an overview of that program.
Well, the idea originally when the legislature approved it was we had 16 slots we could fill, and we had 5 years to fill them. And the program was so successful that we filled those 16 slots in 2 years. So we went back to the legislature and said, will you allow us to do a second round? We believe we have the money available, but we need permission to shift it from where it was at to a second group of 16. The legislature approved that. And so now we have 17 counties signed up, and we believe we could probably have up to five more probably in the next 6 months. Well, we've known all along that that's nice to be eligible if you're a county under 10,000, but many of our larger counties have towns that are small, but they want an attorney too. And the most obvious example is Wall, which is, I don't know, what, 40, 50 miles from Rapid City. They could use an attorney, but they're in Pennington County, obviously has more than 10,000 people, so they don't qualify under the current program. So we're asking the legislature to modify the law so that smaller cities under 3,000, no matter if they're in a large or a small county, the city could participate in the program, a Wall, a Groton, any number of those kinds of towns. And there, we've talked to the Municipal League, and there's interest there.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. My guest is Chief Justice David Gilbertson. He gave his State of the Judiciary address yesterday in Pierre. You can listen to that full address online. Just download the SDNet app or go online to our website, sdpb.org. We're kind of walking through some of the key points in that address for those of you who have not listened to it in its entirety. And, sir, I'm wondering if we could talk about this bar exam. You were very succinct on how you felt about modifying the state bar exam to a standardized test. How so?
Well, many states have gone to a standardized test for various reasons. And we have not. And the main reason we have not is because we test on the subject of Indian law, given we have 9 reservations in this state. Each one has its own government, its own court system. And we feel that if you're going to be a lawyer licensed to practice in South Dakota, that is such an important legal subject. We want those lawyers in South Dakota to be able to competently represent clients in that area. And so in 2002, at my urging, the Supreme Court said we are going to test on Indian law as part of the bar exam. And that is only New Mexico and South Dakota do it. So that would preclude us from going with the standardized program that a lot of other states have done. Each state's got its own priorities. And for the sake of hopping on the bandwagon of a standardized bar exam, I'm not willing to do that, because in the process we would lose that important component we currently have, and that is to assure clients when they go into a lawyer and it's an issue or a problem they have and it deals with Indian law, that lawyer is competent to give them professional advice.
Mm-hmm. Let's finish up with the Supreme Court Law Library, because you said that you had some fun there. Not everything in your job is a good time. Tell me what you found in the restoration process of that law library, which is open to the public during business hours.
Right. Well, the law library had two floors. The second one we knew was added later. And the rumor was there was a missing mural hidden behind the second floor shelves. And so we were able to take that out, because now a lot of the law books aren't needed anymore. The computerized research has really taken over in the law area. And guess what? There was no mural. We took the mezzanine off. But we also found there were blocks at the top of the walls where they painted in names of distinguished Dakota Territorial and early South Dakota Supreme Court justices. Nobody knew they were there. There was gorgeous stenciling and drawings on the ceiling, we found, and all that, sadly, and I don't know why they did it, but they just painted over it, probably in the 1930s. And the other problem we had was we really didn't know what the law library looked like when the building was open, and then somebody ran across a 1911 Western Architectural Digest magazine, and something
was just laying around,
yeah, something not too heavily read.
Right.
And there was a picture of the law library when it was opened, along with some other pictures of the Capitol. So now we knew what we could do, and so we were able to get permission from the legislature to spend some money to have it look as close as we can to the way it was when the Capitol was opened in 1911, but yet it's still a fully functioning law library. It's going to have about half the books that we had before we did the alterations, but more importantly, it's going to have computer terminals, which most lawyers now use for legal research. So we really got the best of both worlds, and it's simply gorgeous.
Chief Justice David Gilbertson, we thank you so much for your time. You've been very generous. We appreciate it.
Sure.
And you can find the entire State of the Judiciary address online, listen.sdpb.org. Don't forget to download the SDNet app, where you can hear all kinds of stuff that's happening in Pierre right now. There's a schedule there on that app as well. After the break, State Tourism Secretary Jim Hagan is with us. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We continue to take the pulse in Pierre. With us now via phone from Pierre is the state's Secretary of Tourism, Jim Hagan. Welcome, sir, to In the Moment.
Thank you, Lori. Happy New Year, and congrats on the new show.
Thank you so much. Yeah. Happy New Year to you, too.
Thank you.
Tourism conference time, exclamation point, exclamation point.
You know me well. I like my exclamation points.
All capital letters.
Yes.
So tell us what that's all about and why it's such a thrill.
Yeah, you know, it's our annual gathering. It's always the third week or so in January. And it's truly the time that we can come together as an industry, everybody, and celebrate the year, celebrate our successes, talk about our challenges, network with one another, and talk about what's ahead for 2017. I think one thing that probably our listeners don't know is that the South Dakota State Tourism Conference, the Governor's Conference on Tourism, has now grown into, depending upon the year, the fourth, fifth, or sixth largest tourism conference in the country, state tourism conference in the country. So we're really excited about that. This year we've got dynamic keynote speakers. First keynote speaker will be next Wednesday morning, January 18th. Jonah Berger, who's written several New York Times best-selling books. He's a marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School. And his latest book is called Why Things Catch On. And it's why certain things take off in marketing. So the conference officially kicks off on Tuesday night, the 17th, with the reception, and then with our first keynote on Wednesday morning. So it'll be a good couple of days.
What are we celebrating right now? What are some of the high points in South Dakota?
You know, I can't spill the beans too much, because I have to wait and let the governor and the lieutenant governor do that next week. But we do have all of our analysis done for 2016, and my staff will probably come knocking on my door, or knocking my door down here if I let the cat out of the bag too much. But what I can tell you is that it was a good year. You know, 2015 was a record-setting year for South Dakota. We had two real huge epic anniversaries with the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally and the Governor's, or the Custer State Park Buffalo Roundup. And those drew visitors from all over the globe. And so you go, how do we top that in 2016? But 2016, we saw the 75th anniversary of the completion of Mount Rushmore. It was the centennial celebration of the National Park Service, and those really drew visitors into South Dakota. Our state parks did well. So it was I was really happy with the numbers that we're seeing. It was a better year than I thought it was, but we're always looking to do better. So it'll be fun next week to share those numbers with the industry and with all of South Dakota. You know, it's significant. Tourism is a major economic driver in this state. Adding, you know, visitor spending alone is around $3.7 billion in 2015. And that contributes about $2.5 billion to the gross domestic product in South Dakota. Tourism, either directly or indirectly, is employing almost 53,000 South Dakotans. So it really is driving a lot. And in a year when our ag sector was having some challenges and some, you know, sales tax was down, all those things, those ripple through other sectors of the economy like tourism. But I'm really happy to see the numbers and that tourism really is a bright spot for 2016, excuse me.
Right. What are we looking forward to in 2017? Do we have big landmark events?
Yeah. You know, we don't have those big epic anniversaries we've had the last couple of years, but every year we're refining our marketing to make sure that we're in the right markets. We're using the right tactics, we're on the right platforms, we're reaching the right audiences. We feel as good as ever about 2017. Two things I will share is, one, we began our peak season marketing for 2017 earlier than we ever have. Normally, we would start the process in about mid-March with some traditional television, print, digital marketing, social media campaigns, etc. Our research really showed over the last 9 months that our visitors were planning even further in advance. So we actually began our 27 peak season marketing on Black Friday this year. Okay. So if you were at the Mall of America in Minneapolis or Southdale Shopping Center in Minneapolis or in Madison, Wisconsin or Milwaukee or Chicago, you were already seeing advertisements for South Dakota. And what we were finding is families were telling us as they gathered for the holidays, that was their time to start planning for the summer and where they were going to vacation as a family. And so we wanted to get right in front of them. And the feedback we've received in the last couple of weeks has been really cool, saying, hey, it was fun to be out shopping, be reminded about South Dakota, and to think about our summer vacation. So it accomplished exactly what we wanted it to.
Then you spend less money. You hold a little bit back for the vacation. Like, I don't need that new technology trinket because I'd rather go to South Dakota.
Exactly.
And get away from it all.
Exactly. The other thing I can share with our listeners is that we will be adding a new primary market for 2017, which is Denver, Colorado. So we've been in the front range of Colorado. We've really started to see that pick up in performance with visitors, especially in the Black Hills area, over the last couple of years, so we're excited to get into Denver in a deeper way.
So why do things catch on? Let's go back to your keynote speaker's title there. You know why things catch on for South Dakota. What are your thoughts?
Right. You know, I think it's really interesting. We just had our budget hearing this morning, and we were talking to some of the Appropriation Committee members. You know, there are those certain iconic attractions in South Dakota that will always be there for us. Mount Rushmore, by far, is our number one iconic attraction, and it's a huge hook for us. You know, and you extend out from there to places like the Crazy Horse Memorial or Historic Deadwood or Spearfish Canyon or the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally or down into Hot Springs and the Mammoth Site. I think the one thing that is really cool, what we're starting to see, Lori, is we've had visitors generation after generation coming to South Dakota. They really know Western South Dakota well. They love it, and they love the experiences there. But we're really starting to see them now turn their attention to the rest of the state. They love the Black Hills, and now they're saying, okay, let's experience that. But what is there in central South Dakota? What is there for Native American culture? How about a powwow or a rodeo or the Missouri River? Let's get over into southeast South Dakota. We've heard so much about Sioux Falls on the national news in the arts and culture scene there and the emerging culinary scene.
Yes.
Yeah, the emerging culinary scene and the brewery scene.
Yeah.
We've heard about this National Music Museum down in Vermilion, or we've heard about Lewis and Clark in Rec Area and Yankton or Ingalls Homestead or the Redlands Center. It's so much fun to see our visitors starting to explore South Dakota even more into every corner. So, those iconic things have really helped us catch on, and now they're allowing these new doors and windows of opportunity to open for these other attractions and businesses.
If you're just joining us, you're in The Moment, SDPB Radio. Jim Hagen is our guest. He's South Dakota's Secretary of Tourism. And I'm wondering, sir, if you have legislative priorities for your department this year.
So this year, we don't have any legislation before either body. I'm not quite sure. I'm not aware of too many tourism-related bills, or maybe one or two, and I don't know quite yet if those bills are going to be introduced, and so I probably won't expound upon that too much. But we don't have a big legislative priority. One thing that catches a lot of South Dakotans off guard when I talk to them is they don't realize that tourism doesn't get any we don't receive any general fund dollars from the state. So we are solely funded by a 1.5% tourism promotion tax, and we also receive money from historic Deadwood gaming revenue, and so solely funded by that. So every year, we're going before the Appropriations Committee in the legislature to talk about our budget, talk about how the promotion tax is doing, and then talk about our plans for the next year. So nothing too major at this point in time, but, things could change too.
We've talked to a couple of incoming lawmakers and about the transgender bathroom bill from last year, whether or not that would be back. How much does something like that have the potential to affect your department and
right.
the state?
Yeah, well, we definitely keep an eye on that. I mean, there have been issues through the years, other issues. It could be, something, abortion. It could be same-sex marriage. But we're not the only state that deal with those sort of challenges and legislative issues. And so it's just something for us to keep an eye on. I don't know where things are going to head this year. And so it's just something, the one thing that I want to stress to visitors all across the country is, whatever happens through the legislative process, I want them to know that the tourism industry in South Dakota we are some of the most welcoming folks, understanding, friendly folks in the country. The thing that I hear consistently, Lori, and we heard it again this morning in our Appropriations Committee from the chair, who said, every time I'm traveling outside our borders, I hear people say to me all the time, we love coming to South Dakota and exploring everything, but it's the people that make the difference. And we really, truly feel that way about our industry, that it is a truly welcoming industry. And regardless of where you come from or what your beliefs are, when you come across our borders, we don't check your driver's license to see what your political registration is or what your beliefs are. This is a welcoming state for everybody.
Governor Dennis Dugard, in his State of the State address, talked about a lot of land transfers and the potential for Spearfish State Park, potential sale of Star Academy. Do any of these sort of bump up on your radar as well as something that you're paying attention to
sure.
for the future?
Yeah, great question. Definitely. I mean, we're definitely interested in the proposed new park in Spearfish Canyon, and understand definitely the concerns that are out there. And so I think it's really prudent and wise of Game Fish and Parks in the governor's office to be out with these listening tours and meetings to hear exactly what the concerns are, because those are always helpful. And I think items are brought up that you may not have thought about potentially. So one thing we do know is that our visitors love the great outdoors in South Dakota. They love the Black Hills for hiking and biking and just the scenic beauty of it all. And so I really give very high props to our Game Fish and Parks Department for running outstanding state parks. I've been to a lot of states, and their state parks don't hold a candle to ours. We have really conscientious Game Fish and Parks employees who know that we can't overdevelop what we have, and so they do a really nice job of developing and keeping things feeling very authentic in our state parks, and yet providing modern amenities that visitors expect. So we'll keep a close eye on that. One thing that we always want to do is when our visitors come, we do want to give them a first-class world experience when they're here. And so I think there's a lot of potential for this new state park in Spearfish Canyon, but we also have to hear those concerns that are out there and address those.
Jim Hagen is South Dakota's Secretary of Tourism. Thank you, sir, so much for joining us today. We appreciate your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Have a good day.
You too.
With us now in the studio is SDPB's Nate Weck. Nate was informing me about the latest news in the NFL last week because I have been watching and I was a little clueless. So he joins us here now with news for you. We're going to talk about a former South Dakota College standout, Nate Weck. Welcome to In the Moment.
Hey, Lori, how you doing?
Good. Who are we talking about today?
Zach Zenner, the South Dakota State grad. He's a native from Eagan, Minnesota. This is just finished up his second year in the National Football League with the Detroit Lions. Detroit Lions actually had 17 games this year because they made the postseason, made it to the wild card round, and then, of course, got beat last week by the Seattle Seahawks. So Zach Zenner and the Detroit Lions season is over, but he found himself as a starter later in the season, which is something. He started number four on the depth chart, and usually if you're number four as a running back on the depth chart, you're kind of flirting with that area of, am I going to get demoted to the practice squad or am I going to get cut altogether? He stuck around. There were some injuries, and he ended up getting bumped up and had four rushing touchdowns on the season, which is pretty impressive for a guy that started number four on the depth chart to have a really, he took advantage of those opportunities right. That were presented to him.
What do we know about his character that would help us figure out how he did that or how he got there?
You know, he's at SDSU, he had 2,000 yards rushing three seasons. His sophomore, junior, and senior year, he was a 2,000-yard rusher. He's also a pre-med major, so he's very disciplined with that. He actually got accepted to the medical school down here at the University of South Dakota, but ended up deciding to enter the NFL draft in 2015 instead of go to med school. He wanted to give football a try. And he went undrafted, and the Detroit Lions ended up picking him up and giving him a shot in training camp, and he ended up earning a roster spot. So it's kind of a Cinderella story, and to actually see him play, and one of his best performances of the year came against the Dallas Cowboys on Monday Night Football. You know, growing up, these athletes, they sit and they watch Monday Night Football. You know, as a kid, you know, even myself watching Monday Night Football, that's where the stars are playing, you know. And for Zach Zenner to have an opportunity to play on Monday Night Football in Dallas in that massive stadium that it's called Jerry Jones Palace, you know, for a reason, you know, or it really is a palace down there. And for him to come out and had two rushing touchdowns in that game, it was kind of that breakout game where they were like, you know what, this kid actually does have something, and I think he's earned a spot to continue playing for us.
All right, you listened in to some of the press conference or
yep.
Some of his thoughts at the end of the season. What are you bringing us today to listen to?
Yep, he basically, this was kind of the week where the Detroit Lions players came in and cleared out the locker rooms and to go into the offseason now that their season's over. One of the things that Zenner did talk about was you got to seize the opportunities.
People come and go. You know, you got to keep working. You have to earn your spot every time. So although it was, you know, those were good opportunities, and I think I took advantage of them as best I could, I'm still going to need to keep taking advantage of the opportunities in the future. Nothing's going to be handed to me or given to me. That's the way the NFL is, and that's one of the reasons why I like it so much.
No entitlement there.
No, very, very much a, seems like he's got a very good head on his shoulders, and like some athletes, they don't really know how to talk to the media. They kind of can run into some problems at times where it seems like Zenner knows what to say. He's not very selfish from that aspect, or at least that's the way he comes off. Kind of adds to how strong of a character he has.
Yeah. So what happens for him in the offseason?
Well, now this offseason, last offseason, he ended up doing a research project at a medical school in Detroit. This year, he's also going to be doing another research project at the VA in Detroit. So he's still working on staying up on the stuff that he needs to do on the medical side so that if the NFL dream doesn't work out for him in 2-3 years, you know, he decides he wants to go the medical route, he can still do that. So he's taking the necessary steps in the offseason, and he actually spoke about that during the press conference as well, and he kind of compared studying and stuff like that a little bit to kind of his times as a student athlete up at SDSU.
You know, really it just kind of brings me back to the SDSU days, you know, the college days where you got school and then you go to football and then you study at night. You study both football and school at night. On this off season, we don't have nearly as much football stuff going on. I put it this way, there's no way I would be able to do this in season. In my opinion. No, I know there are some people that do some things in season, school-related-wise, but as far as these research projects, they require a lot of my time and attention.
So he wants to help veterans. He remembers where he came from, what he learned in South Dakota. Work hard, earn your spot. I like him.
Yep, exactly. And again, next year there's going to be healthy running backs again. Then there's a whole other draft and free agency. So he's going to have to earn that spot again if he wants to remain on the roster next year for the Detroit Lions.
Nate Weck, thanks for stopping by. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Lori.
After the break, Independent Lens features the documentary What Was Ours. We'll talk with the filmmakers about sacred objects and reclaiming ancestral artifacts. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. For the Shoshone and Arapaho tribes living on the isolated Wind River Indian Reservation in Wyoming, new contact with lost artifacts risks opening old wounds, but also offers the possibility for healing. What Was Ours is a film directed, a documentary film directed by Matt Hames, or Hames, well, Hames, there we go. Sorry about that, Matt. It premieres on Independent Lens Monday, January 16, 9 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Mountain, SDPB TV. Joining us now via phone, director Matt Hames. Matt, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you for having me.
And we're reaching Matt in Austin from Rivertown or Riverton, Wyoming. Jordan Dresser is also with us. Jordan, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you.
Matt, I let's start with you, and I'm wondering how you met Jordan and sort of first became involved in this project as a filmmaker.
Yeah, in 2011, I was working on a project that involved basically creating an archive of ancestral objects that belonged to the Arapaho and the Shoshone people who both share the Wind River Reservation. And I was working on that project and met Jordan Dresser, and started working together with Jordan Dresser on that project. And as that project was kind of wrapping up, Jordan was doing some really interesting things, working on getting a small tribal museum going on the reservation. And so I just kept kind of talking to Jordan and following his story and the story of Michaela Sunrhodes and then Philbert McLeod, two other people that lived on the reservation. And then it just kind of grew from there into a feature documentary.
And Jordan is featured throughout the film, as Matt said. Jordan, can you explain to me, in the beginning of this film, we actually meet Philbert, and he's talking about what a sacred object is via a story about his time in Vietnam. But let's talk about objects itself and why they are sacred in this culture.
It's the idea that Native people have always created things that had meaning and significance, and not only did items were used in everyday life, but a lot of them had special meaning, not only from the person who made them, but also with just different designs. And it was just that tribal people always took in consideration that the things that we were given are gifts from the Creator.
It's not just stuff.
Yeah, it's not just items. And that's the big thing about these items in the museum, is that, you know, a lot of these are, some of them in a sense are, you don't see being practiced every day by Native people, like the parfleshes, which are rawhide bags. You don't see a lot of that amongst tribal people. So it's the idea that a lot of these items we can learn from and see how our people used to do different things so we could carry on those traditions.
How does storytelling fit into that? How is the story part of the tradition and part of the item or the object? Jordan?
Well, it's the idea that everything is made with a purpose, and that if you talk to a person, especially today, you know, I think Michaela Sunrhodes is a very good part in the film because she's an artist who's actively making things. So she can tell you a story behind something that she's beading. I just recently bought some earrings from her recently, and she was telling me the story behind it. It's not just something you look at that's beautiful. It's something that has significance.
And so tell me, Jordan, a little bit about the origins of this museum and where you started looking first to find collections of tribal artifacts that once lived or resided on Wind River Reservation.
I work for the Wind River Hotel and Casino, and in 2012, we opened up our first hotel. And in it, we have a small cultural room we call the Northern Arapaho Experience. So we started working on that project, and we were looking for things to put in there, and we didn't have any sense of where to go or where to find different things. So I just started asking around with different tribal members of, like, where they kind of remember seeing different artifacts. And there was a local museum located on the reservation that housed quite a bit of a collection of items. So we started kind of poking around and asking questions of where those items were and could we possibly display some.
And you say at this point we always have to ask permission.
Yes.
To explain to me what that's like to have to sort of negotiate these items from a church that really belonged, to the tribe previously.
Well, the best way I can describe it, it's almost like having a kid and you and the other person divorce or whatever, and that other person has primary custody. And so you're asking, can I see my child? Can I see this person? And so that's the same concept, especially with these items. It's very, when you're in the moment of it, you feel very, it's like a feeling of, you get angry sometimes and you get sad sometimes. And also you get lonely for the items themselves because you wonder about their stories and what they're going through. And you wonder if this is the right place for them. But in the end, to me, anytime a tribal item can be with whatever tribe they come from, to me, that's a good thing because it brings back those connections together.
Matt Hames, let's bring you back into the conversation. And you capture in this film, I think, particularly effectively, the emotion. As Jordan talks about, there are a variety of emotions, and you do that with a delicacy that really stood out to me as a filmmaker. How did you sort of navigate that, where people are going through a variety of emotions, from anger to sadness to regret to apprehension? What was that like for you to try to capture on film?
Thank you. Well, slowly. I made a few trips up to the reservation initially just to sort of talk to people and get to know them a bit before doing any filming. And unfortunately, there's been so much, there's been a certain type of film made or a certain type of media story that's been made that you can almost sort of stamp out that has the same kind of narratives about, reservation life and what that's like. And I wanted to completely avoid all of those cliches as much as possible. And part of that was just the people that I met when I first went there were Jordan and Michaela and Filbert. And their three personalities really dictated the tone of the film. You don't really rush things when you're there. And Jordan describes that really well in the film. And so it's just a different pace of life there. And I think that in a way that really influenced the style of the film. The film is a bit, it's I wouldn't say that it's slow paced, but it's a bit meditative and purposeful. And just being around their families and the people there and the way they live their lives really dictated the style that I approached the film with, and especially editing the film with my co-editors. We just really wanted to be true to the people on the reservation and how they experience time, which is a bit different than, I think, an urban environment.
And that's the other thing I was going to mention about this film is that it's just not often that you see a documentary where you experience reservation or tribal life just sitting and having dinner. Just sitting and giving Jordan a cake as he goes on to his next college adventure. You just don't see that on the screen very often. Did you have that in your mind as well?
Moments.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're beautiful moments that are real, and I think they're just as real or more real than the kind of the typical media portrayal of reservation life.
Yeah.
And so it was great to be welcomed into that, and I was really fortunate that they had trust because there was like I said, there'd been a lot of journalists that had gone in and done quick stories on a quick deadline that had just kind of painted the place in a very negative light.
Right. Well, we thank you for that. And Jordan, there's a trip to the Field Museum of Chicago because there's a large collection there. Tell me about that journey for the folks who went on it and what's housed there.
The Field Museum has a wide collection of especially Plains Indian items. And going in, I had no idea to the extent of it. And I think going there, especially for everybody, I think it really was mind-blowing just because it was just like shelves upon shelves upon shelves upon shelves of just items that just are tucked away. And a lot of them just have just such significance. And a lot of them are so alive, like they're just so bright and they're just in such in good condition. And it was just really mind-blowing, like, just to see that collected there. But it was also sad to think that there's these items that are just removed from their people, that who could interpret them and also learn from them and care for them and also teach the younger generation about how we lived as tribal people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment SDPB Radio. We're talking about a film called What Was Ours. You can see it on Monday, January 16th on SDPB TV. That's at 9 o'clock p.m. Central Time, 8 Mountain. It's part of Independent Lens. It's a feature documentary. We're talking to filmmaker Matt Hames and Jordan Dresser. Jordan is featured in the film throughout. And Jordan, you go on to study sort of museum studies in graduate school. Is this the notion of a museum, does it have a connection to tribal life, or is it so completely different? Is it a European tradition, this notion of a museum itself?
Well, if you think about it in the classical sense, I think that a museum, would it make sense? Because a museum was very about people from all over the world, but also about how things were in a certain time frame. You know, they're very dated and very dated exhibits and things like that. But museums today are really becoming sites of, like, very exciting exhibits and stories that tell hard stories that need to be told. And the idea of a museum within Indian country has a large history. You know, some of the earliest tribal museums go back to the 1950s. The Osage tribe has one of the oldest museums tribal museum in the country. So it's the idea that tribes are really changing and adapting the concept of a museum and making it a living place where that transfer of knowledge is occurring to the younger generation. And it's the idea that people are caring for the items in their traditional sense, and that they're decolonizing even the names of them and putting them with the rather than label them as a basket or whatever, they're giving them the traditional tribal names that they once had. So museums can be incredible sites of power.
Our guests, Jordan Dresser and Matt Hames, the film once again is called What Was Ours. It premieres on Independent Lens Monday, January 16th. Tune in at 9 p.m. on SDPB TV. That's Central Time. You'll want to tune in at 8 p.m. if you live in Mountain Time. Gentlemen, I want to say thank you so much. It's a beautiful film, and thank you for sharing it with us. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you for having us.
And thanks,
really,
Jordan.
Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Have a good afternoon. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Steve Zwemke and Chris Loffrey. Executive producer Kara Hetland. Want to thank all our guests and tune in tomorrow, Fridays, our special on South Dakota Public Broadcasting Radio. Tomorrow on In the Moment, we sit down with Delta David Geyer with the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra. He brings with him composer Theodore Wiprund. They have an upcoming concert and a premiere of a piece that was written particularly for the symphony, also music from David Dondero and 35th and Taylor. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.